You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I wanted the fame, but not the cover of Newsweek. Oh well, guess beggars can't be choosy. Wanted to receive attention from my music. Wanted to be left alone.
All right, so let me set this up. General Neil got on my radar because a mutual friend said, "Hey, have you seen General Neil's book?" I said, "I have not," and sent me a link, and then introduced us via the email. So I emailed him and I said, "Hey, so I'd love to have you on and talk about your book." So we talked about him coming on, and he said, "How would you like to do it?" So I started reading some of his book, and he talked about the events of June 30, 31, 1967, had a profound effect on him, blah, 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 blah. So I figured that, well, Mac, maybe you should, you know, dive into that. And so I did, and I asked him, I said, "Hey, would you mind if we did a battlefield study on that? And then come back on a second time and talk about the book." And he said, "Not a bit." So what you're going to hear right now is in fact that. It's the battlefield study with former assistant commandant of the Marine Corps. But during the period that we're going to talk about today, he is a second lieutenant. He's an artillery officer. Yeah, I gave him some grief about that. I'm like, "Sir, you weren't even a grunt." He goes, "I know, not bad. Not bad, huh, Mac?" And I started off, and he said something like, "Not bad for a piece of shit arty guy, huh?" I said, "Oh, I didn't say that." He said, "Yeah, I know, but you're a grunt. You guys all think alike." I said, wow, or is that really where we're going? He said, "Look, I know you guys. It's not like I haven't heard it in my life." I was like, "Oh, okay, sir." So again, without further ado, it was my privilege, and he's a wonderful guy. You know, one of the things I enjoy about the different Marines you cross paths with, they're all different. Butch Neal, and you'll hear his story. I mean, he was a garbage man as a teenager. I want to say for 6 years. His father had passed away. He helped support his mom and sisters, put himself through college. No, he's a normal guy. Normal guy. And he rose to great things in the Marine Corps for his country. So it's my privilege to have him on All Marine Radio. And without further ado, here is Richard I. You'll find out what the I stands for. Stand by for that one. And Richard I. Butch Neal, retired General, United States Marine Corps, 4-star type, and former assistant commandant of the Marine Corps. That's not him, just so you know. I'll have to shut her up now. One of the most popular segments on All Marine Radio now is our battlefield study segment. And I'm honored this morning to have on with us retired Marine Corps General Butch Neal. His given name is Richard, middle initial I, but I've never heard anybody in my life refer to him as anything other than either General or Butch. So, sir, first of all, good morning. Welcome to All Marine Radio.
Hi, good morning, Mac. Glad to be with you today.
All right. First of all, what does I stand for? That's not a very common middle initial. What did you get tagged with?
Oh, my mother. I argued with her for a long time about that. Irving. I don't know where the hell she got it. I think it was one of her favorite uncles or something. But anyways, it's Richard Irving Neal.
You know what? I'm Michael Francis McNamara, which didn't get legitimate until recently. Everybody, when I was a kid... Remember those stupid Francis the Talking Mule movies with Donald O'Connor? Oh, yeah. So the first day of Catholic school, Michael, Francis, my friends. And but now that the Pope's Francis, it's legit. So I guess when we get Pope Irving, you'll be in the front row. But until then,
I'll be in the front row. I'll be ready to go.
We're gonna talk about your background a little bit. And then we're gonna bring you back and General Neal's written a book that's a great read. It's called What Now, Lieutenant? And for those of us who've been lieutenants, it's something that gets posed to you all the time. If you've ever taught lieutenants, something you certainly ask them all the time. But it's a great read, and he's going to come back, and we're going to talk about his book probably next week. Today we're doing battlefield study, and specifically we're going to look at his time in Vietnam in 1966 and 1967. And specifically on March 31st of 1967. So before we get there, sir, give everybody a thumbnail bio of you.
Just Marine Corps?
No, we need to hear about Hull, Massachusetts, for God's sake.
Yeah. Born in Hull, Mass. Old-timer by now, but... small town, a peninsula, just right out in the middle of Boston Harbor, and a great place to grow up. I was down on the end of the peninsula, in a place called The Village, and there's only about, probably in the wintertime, about seven or eight close friends that I had to play with. The town, because it was a seacoast town, in the winter we could drop down to 5,000 or 6,000 people, and then the winter it would blossom all the way up to 10,000 to 15,000 people because they'd come in the summer and they have summer cottages. It also had an amusement park there called Paragon Park, and a steamboat used to run from Boston down to it, dropping off sometimes 1,000 people at a whack, and they would go and enjoy the beach and enjoy the amusement park and then get back on the boat and go back up to Boston at the end of the day. Anyways, went to high school there, Howe High School, and then on graduation from there, was accepted at Northeastern University. It's a 5-year cooperative education school. For those not familiar with it, basically, Northeastern, your first year is traditional 1 year of college courses, and then the next 4 years, they alternate between a job that is some hopefully connected to what your major is in college, and it's a way for you to earn money enough to hopefully pay for your tuition while at the same time getting on-the-job training. And then you'd go back to school for a semester and then back out to work in the same place or a different one depending upon what your major was and so on and so forth for 4 more years. So that's how I did it. Got my education. My dad had died when I was 14, and so we really didn't have any money. So this worked out to be a great way to get through college. And it allowed me to, I had a job in the town. I was a rubbish, garbage man for, I guess, about 6 years while in college and before college. And that allowed me to generate income, not only to help my mom take care of my two sisters, but at the same time allowed me to pay my tuition. So when I graduated, I was pretty much debt-free. While there at Northeastern, I joined the ROTC, Army ROTC program. I was a commuter. We were commuting 30 miles each way every day. So my other carpoolies, my schedule with the ROTC just didn't work out. So I had heard a program called Platoon Leaders Class PLC from a buddy of mine, and signed up for that, quit the ROTC, signed up for the PLC program, and when I graduated from Northeastern, I was commissioned a second lieutenant, and that was the beginning of my Marine Corps career.
So let me ask you, first of all, give me a couple lessons learned from being a garbage man.
You never know what you're going to find. always put down, in fact, my wife's dad said that I was the best G-man he ever had because I always closed the cover on the garbage because we used to pick up the garbage early in the morning. Right. We kept it separated from the regular trash, because I think the town sold it to a pig farmer or something. And so we would get off the truck and have a barrel. It didn't have plastic at that time. They had metal barrels. We'd go and empty out these underground garbage containers into the barrel, and you'd get to about four houses. You could just barely walk and go out and empty it and then go again. So you had to fight maggots and the smell, but, after that it was just, the payday came, so it all made it worthwhile.
The Marine Corps, the Marine Corps, you would have been an Army officer if the Army would have had some kind of PLC program that would have conformed or been better tailored to your work schedule throughout the summer. Had the Marine Corps never darkened your doorstep?
Yeah, no, they really hadn't, and I hadn't really thought about it. This buddy of mine who went in the Marine Corps, he was out at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, we were talking about, I would tell him I was having problems with the ROTC program because of my commuter status. And he said, geez, I just signed up for this PLC, and you can go either one 10-week segment one summer, or you can go two 6-week segments and two summers. And that was attractive to me because if I did the two 6-week increments, I could still do my summer job. And the guy that owned the rubbish and trash business, he guaranteed I'd have the job when I came back, so it just worked out perfectly, and I didn't have to worry about upsetting my carpool or the members of the carpool, so that I could meet my school obligations, my commuter obligations, and at the same time, I had already made the decision that I was going to go in the military for at least 3 or 4 years, and just kind of, that's kind of one of those, a given, I guess. I had already made that decision. I never thought about staying in, but I did talk about going for 3 or 4 years.
What the Vietnam War is starting at about this time. Had you you grew up in a time in our country that just about, I'm sure, everybody who taught you, all the men that taught you, all the men who coached you, and most of the men in town were veterans. Did you have any thoughts about the war at that time? You sound like a pretty busy guy in terms of, becoming a teacher, getting your degree, supporting your family. Did you have thoughts about the war?
You know, I really didn't. You're absolutely right. I was born in 42, so, World War II was just cranking up. My dad and his four brothers all went into the military, none in the Marines, but in the Army and in the Navy, and one went into the Merchant Marines. And then I can always remember seeing the parades going down the main street in the small town of Hull after the war was over, celebrating the victory. And so I was always kind of enamored or excited about the military and things military. I had a lot of post-war books that came out and I was an avid reader even then, going through them, and a lot of the pictorial books that they came out that showed you the different things. And then, of course, there was the TV show Victory at Sea that was the main staple at that time. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think I ever did not entertain thoughts of going in the military. I think that was just kind of a natural plan after college was to go in the military, and obviously, by virtue of either going through the ROTC program or the PLC program, I was going to go in as a commissioned officer.
Talk to us about becoming an artillery officer and going to Vietnam. What was the Marine Corps like then? If you were in for 20 years at that point, you had come into Marine Corps in 1945 or just before that, so you're a World War II guy. I'm sure there's plenty of Korean War guys around as well. What was the Marine Corps like then?
It was funny. The PLC guys, the staff NCOs that were the instructors and folks that the controlling authority, I guess, for us, and PLCs, most of them, or a lot of them, were Korean War vets. And it was kind of funny, they were just they were interesting characters, I guess would be the best way to put it. When I went to basic school, we had guys that were coming back from Vietnam, so basic school being, that first school after commissioning where you kind of learn your profession before you go out and do Marine things. So, yeah, it was kind of funny. I really didn't have a great sense about Vietnam. You know, I read about it in the paper. It wasn't really a hot topic in college. Of course, I think it was my junior or senior year. That's when Kennedy was assassinated. And, of course, he was one of the five presidents who were actually involved in the Vietnam experience. So I don't think the war bothered me too much when I raised my hand and took the oath of office after the graduation ceremony. I was the only guy in a sea of black gowns. I was the only one in white. At that time, we had the white uniform. So it was in Boston. I think it was Boston Gardens or Boston Arena. And, you know, I was the only one in a white uniform. I looked like an ice cream salesman. But that was it.
The talk to us about you wanted to be an infantry officer. What happened? Did you ever get, why did David Neal be an infantry officer?
You know, that was one of the big disappointments early on in the military, in the Marine Corps. You know, I just thought that being a Marine meant being an infantry officer. You know, it just didn't seem like the other service specialties or other MOSs were really, they just didn't appeal to me. I never even doubted that I wouldn't be an infantry officer. So I think at that time we had to make three choices. I think if I recall, I put down infantry officer, artillery officer, and tanker. I think those were the three that I put down there. You know, some guys would kid and say, oh, I'm going to be motor T and out in three. And, you know, there's all kinds of conversations like that. But I never expected that I wouldn't be an infantry officer. And so when that list came out, I was really disappointed. Went and saw the SBC, Captain Pierpan at that time, Herb Pierpan, and, you know, I said, is there a way I can appeal this and stuff like that? He said, no, I put you in for it, but, you know, needs of the Marine Corps prevail. And he said, but I'll tell you one thing. He said, you know, he had just come back from Vietnam. He said, you know, the guy that was at my side all the time was my FO. So, you know, just, you know, get your MOS and be the best FO that the Marine Corps can send to the fleet. So I kind of took that advice, and from the rest of it was history.
The what was you said you go to Fort Sill, and anything change your life at Fort Sill?
No, I just it was kind of funny at that time in the Marine Corps. The only officers that didn't go to a follow-on school after the basic school for further training in their MOS was the infantry officer. And that was kind of, you know, you reflect back on that and probably shame on us. We now have the infantry officers course, IOC. And, of course, the infantry officers go to that before they go out to the fleet, just as the artillery officers go to Fort Sill before going out to the fleet and the motor T guys and so on and so forth. But, no, Fort Sill was okay. Good guys I was with, plus there was, you know, it was both Army and Marines, and it was competitive environment again. But, you know, the war, now we knew where the next duty station was, which was Vietnam, and, it just kind of all gelled, and things were going good. I just knew I took Pierre Pan's advice to heart and just made sure that I understood artillery from A to Z. And of course, one of the benefits of going to Fort Sill was there was a lot, heavy emphasis on map reading, because that's really what a FO has got to do, is be able to bring rounds in to support the ground guys. And so I was, you know, I wanted to be the best map reader. And but in those days, we didn't have GPS. We had the ones that had compass and maps. And I got good at it.
You know, sir, I don't want you to think I'm a dork or anything like that, because I am actually an infantry officer. But on Saturday this past, as I was reading about your book and a couple other things, I have one of the things I've learned the most about since starting to do All Marine Radio is Vietnam. Vietnam is so different depending on the year, depending on where you are in the country, that it's amazing. And but I've learned a ton about it through just interviewing different guys that were there. And I tend to plot my stuff on Google Earth. I'll pull up Google Earth and I'll put push pins in. But I didn't have an overlay of the DMZ. And in the fight we're going to talk about is in proximity to this DMZ. And so I spent 3 hours plotting the DMZ on Saturday. On my Google, yeah. I don't know. Again, I know that sounds like I'm a dork. I'm not a dork, though, just for the record. But I love maps, and I specifically love Google Earth now because it's like you can actually see it. It's not like you have to look at somebody's two-dimensional drawing on the page of a book. You know, you can fly there and actually see the terrain, which is in and of itself amazing. So anyway, just so you know, if you ever need a overlay of the DMZ for your Google Earth map, just let me know. Just let me know and I'll send you my file.
I'll get a hold of you for sure.
What? So you complete Fort Sill Artillery Officer Basic Course, and then you're off to Vietnam. Talk about going to Vietnam. What conflict you ever go to, I think there's a sobering moment when you're beginning to fly into that country and. You one, I think, feel your own mortality, and two, you feel that long shadow of the Iwo Jima flag raising extending over you. Talk about as you moved towards Vietnam, what was that experience like for you?
Yeah, well, once I finished Fort Sill, I went out to California at Pendleton and picked up a replacement unit and trained with them. In fact, it was one of the disappointments I can still remember. I was out training with them in the different mountainous areas out there in Las Pulgas, and some of the O3s that were with me at Fort Sill were out there, and they were falling out in the run, and here I am, the guy that wanted to be an O3, and I'm kind of leading the pack, and I'm wondering what the hell went wrong.
Yeah, but
be that as may, I took the Translationist Battalion over to Vietnam, and of course they were, as soon as they landed, they were taken and sorted out and sent to different organizations throughout the Marine Corps that was up. We landed in Da Nang. We stopped in Okinawa for, I guess, about 3 or 4 days and then went on into landing in Da Nang. And I got off the plane. The heat was amazing. I'm wondering, what the hell am I doing here? I wasn't thinking of mortality. I was just thinking of the now. You know, it was hot and it was humid. And they put me in a cabin or whatever I want to call it. I can't remember what the name was. But anyways, I went there, and then that night, this young lieutenant came running in calling for me, and a recon outfit had gotten in trouble, and they wanted to send an artillery FO in to assist them and bring in fire. And they called it a sparrowhawk, and I didn't, I had to sit him down and say, what's a sparrowhawk? That's the first thing. And he said, well, it's a quick reaction force, and we need an FO to go in with the group that's going in. So he outfitted me with a pistol and flak jacket and a helmet, and the pucker factor at that time kicked into high gear, and just when we were about to go out to get aboard the helicopter to join the infantry outfit that was going in as part of the Sparrowhawk, the recon guys broke contact, and there was no need to launch the Sparrowhawk, so I probably lost about 10 pounds in that one 50-minute equation. That was my introduction to Vietnam, the first night or the second night. And then subsequent to that, I was assigned to Fox 212, artillery battery down in An Hoa. Went down there and joined them, and then as well as the procedure, an FO, when he reported in, initially would be assigned to an infantry company, and then later on would come back to the battery to finish out his tour. So I was sent down to Lima Company, 3-9, and then later on joined, I came back to the battery, wasn't really happy with the battery situation, didn't feel like I was involved in the fight, and was able to get sent down to India Company 3-9, and that's where I finished out my first year tour.
The So your first assignment was ANWA. That's what, that's along the coast, or near the coast, south of Chulai?
No, it's south of Da Nang. I never saw a coast. It was in the mountains. Yeah. I don't remember seeing a coast. No, it was down, it was south of Da Nang. You went right down, I think it was Route 5, if I remember right.
Okay.
And, no, it was quite a distance from Da Nang. And, it was in the mountainous area. Well, the mountains were all around us. We were like in a valley. And then, we operated there. And then subsequently they moved us up to the Da Nang area. And, we actually got aboard ship and they sent us back to, Okinawa. Ostensibly to get some new recruits into the battalion. The whole battalion went back, and the battery as well that supported it, to get new troops and also to get introduced to the M16. We at that time were carrying the M14. They didn't issue the M16 at that time, but we got it later on in this tour.
So the first part of your deployment. Give us the major learning curves for you as a second lieutenant. Both give us a couple skill things that you learned, and then a couple leadership things you learned here working with Fox 212.
Yeah, well, I was with Fox 212. That's the artillery battery, of course. Right. And initially, basically, I wasn't the fire direction officer. They already had an officer that was senior to me as the fire direction officer, and I was just—I had a platoon, so I had two guns, 105 howitzers at that particular time, and I was responsible for making sure that they maintained the weapon system, that the troops were attentive and well trained as a gun crew, so that they could fire in support of the infantry. Shortly thereafter, I was assigned to, as I said, Lima Company. 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines. Captain Charlie Pyle was the commanding officer for the company, and I was his FO. I think the thing I learned, or the thing that most importantly, is when you join a new outfit, and particularly as an attachment, in other words, I wasn't part of it, I was attached to it as the FO, is kind of sit and watch and kind of learn from those other officers, the platoon commanders, the company commander. I learned by watching, and I made myself learn all the different weapon systems within that platoon and within the company, so that if I ever had to, operate those particular weapon systems, maybe not in my job description as an FO, at least I would know how to do it. And you never know, you might have to take over a company or a platoon, you never know what you're going to be doing. So I learned by doing. Pyle was a good map reader. I thought I was better, and we used to have some pretty good discussions as to where we were. No easy chore. I can tell you, I fired some smoke rounds, and I'd have to turn around and see where it landed when I looked out where it was supposed to be in front of me. So, live and learn, and practice makes better. So it was a good learning experience. He got malaria. I got rotated back to the to the battery. Again, I wasn't really happy with it, and subsequently I convinced the battery commander they needed a fill for an FO in India Company, and I was able to get that job.
Hey, sir, before we leave Lima 39, in ANWA, who were you predominantly fighting NVA, Viet Cong? And what kind of contact did you have throughout that first tour as an FO?
Yeah, no, not MVA, not that far south. We were fighting Viet Cong, and it was a lot of movement to contact. You weren't expecting big contact. It was kind of hit and run. Every now and then you might run into two or three of them, Viet Cong, but most of the time it was, snipers and going through villages looking for weapons cache and stuff of that nature. But it was the Viet Cong. It was tedious work. It was dangerous work. But we patrolled all the time. Pyle was a stickler for being out and about. There weren't any really big operations that I would say that we were involved in. Most of them were company level and below. Battalion, I can't even remember if we did any battalion as a lieutenant. You know, you kind of, you're divorced from that because you're living the up close and personal, so you're not really here at the tactical level. It's not too much involved with the operational level of war.
Right. So you go to you go back and you get hooked up with India 39. Talk about the genesis of that. Is the genesis of that now I knew this. I didn't tell you when we were talking before, but I know that you're, I don't want to say a bit of a social butterfly because that has the wrong connotation, but what would be an appropriate word? You're gregarious. You're not afraid of a good time. Is the initial basis for your relationship with the officers in 39 social? How do you meet those guys and ultimately wind up getting assigned there?
Yeah, well, I actually probably guilty as charged. I initially met a guy named John Prickett. He was a lieutenant. He was with India Company, but he came over to the battery before we redeployed to Okinawa. And he was looking for our XO. They had both gone to University of Georgia. And so I got to meet him. I really liked him. You know, I could see he's a great Marine, but also, you know, kind of the same temperament as I had, you know, ready to go out and have fun. And so next thing I know, we were in Okinawa getting that 30 days rearm, refurbish, et cetera. And I got to go out with John and a group of officers that made up India Company. And I could tell right away there was a good chemistry there. They were real professional, but they also liked to have a good time. And so that's what caused me to go see my battery commander and say, hey, is there a chance I could get with India? And that's basically what led to me being assigned to India 39 and as we redeployed back into Vietnam. And this time we redeployed up north, so we're up near Camp Carroll and up near the DMZ.
Talk to us about tell me about the company commander. There's a part in your book the first time I read the name John Bobo. I think for anybody who's an infantry officer, anybody who's a Marine Corps officer, that name stands out. And you knew him. You knew him as a friend, also as a colleague. Talk to us about your company commander. Did you say his name? Gittins? How do you say his name?
Getlin. Yeah, Mike Getlin. Yeah, Mike was he had just picked up captain, and I think he was with the 26 Marines, but he made captain, and somehow he ended up down with 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines, and ultimately as the company commander for the battalion, for the company, India Company. The weapons platoon commander was John Bobo, and we had John Prickett he had 1st Platoon, and Ray Gall, who was a Mustang, he had 3rd Platoon, and 2nd Platoon was a brand new lieutenant, Dan Pulse. So they were all great guys. We got to know each other, and, you know, the spirit of camaraderie and brotherhood, I think, blossomed in Okinawa, but then it really came to fruition when we got into Camp Carroll and started to operate as a company. We were involved in a lot of patrolling, did a lot of things together. You know, I watched this new set of leaders, of Getlin on down, had confidence in him, and was really happy that I had made the switch over from the battery to now again out with the infantry. And then, basically the next thing I guess would be talking about 30-31 March.
Well, you know, I'd never, as I said, my ongoing education about Vietnam, I'd never heard of Operation Prairie 1 and 2, let alone 3 or 4. And so I saw those names, and so I went back and I started doing some reading. And for those of you that have never read about, you know, the northern portion of I Corps, I will tell you that you would do yourself a favor if you would get your Google Earth map out, and I'll send you all my overlays. But tell you what, it's a man's fight up there. Not only the terrain, the weather, but there was an enemy there that would close with you, that would hammer you with supporting arms, was good at his field craft, and would close with you. And, you know, again, we haven't faced an enemy like that. You know, I don't know that your enemy in Desert Storm, as I watched from afar here, actually teaching at IOC during that one, and, you know, certainly not in the march up, somebody that would close with you, or in the intervening years, probably our experience was more, very similar to your experience with the VC, onesies and twosies, shoot and scoot, you know, IEDs, you know, much like you all faced in terms of booby traps and things like that, but only ambush you when he had you in a position of extreme inferiority, and then maybe would mass and ball up when he knew it was a sure deal. But the northern part of I Corps was very, very different. Operation, I want to say Prairie One, 12, almost 1,300 North Vietnamese soldiers killed in that operation. And I want to say about 249 Marines killed in that operation. So you see those kind of numbers. And, you know, it's your holy shit moment. Holy shit, man. That's serious stuff. And there was a time on target fired at... how do you say, is it Jiaolin, G-I-O-L-I-N-N, sir? How do you say that?
Jiaolin, yeah. Jiaolin.
A time on target in the space of, I want to say, 7 minutes, they took 400 rounds that the NVA shot at them. And you're like...
Yeah, it was a level playing field fighting with them. The edge we had was air. But let me tell you, they were well-trained. They were well-equipped. Their leaders knew how to fight. They had been fighting a long time. And they weren't afraid to commit forces. And they would take advantage. You know, they knew that if they were close to us, the advantage of the air was mitigated because, you know, the fear of friendly fire. So these guys were good. As I told you, or as I wrote in the book,
right.
You know, when we came around the corner and John got hit and... I mean, the guy that hit him was he had a 30 caliber machine gun on wheels. I mean,
wow.
these guys were good and they knew their tactics. And to those that didn't pay attention to the enemy, they did it at their own peril.
Sir, let me. I also want to ask you about, you know, we see references to, and I see pictures of the terrain. So in the action that we're going to talk about. On March 30, 31 of 1967, you're operating out of Camp Carroll?
That's correct, yeah.
All right,
yeah.
And in the general vicinity of the fight is where?
Cam Low and Contien area,
okay.
Right in that general vicinity. It was a battalion-level operation, and obviously it was orchestrated from the battalion headquarters. They were in the field as well. Although some a preponderance of their headquarters element was still on Camp Carroll.
Got it. The talk to us about the pictures I see are of things like elephant grass. What's the terrain like up there? Because quite honestly, and I'm embarrassed to say this, but I was pretty until a few months ago pretty ignorant of the fighting that went on around Contien, and I was talking about another holy shit moment. You know, wow. What was the terrain like?
Yeah, the terrain was tough. Not only, as you mentioned, the elephant grass, but the jungle itself closed in. And, you know, there were times when we had to machete ourselves way, you know, through areas to just keep moving forward. So, obviously, there was stealth was out of the question. So, yeah, it was really tough. It was hot. It was humid. In the if you got in the elephant grass, which the preponderance of the area we operated in was that, there was not a breath of fresh air. And there was leeches. I never really did see too many snakes, but leeches were terrible all over the place. And you were wet from perspiration. You were wet from crossing streams. You were always drinking water as much as you could carry or as much as you could borrow, because dehydration was a big problem, as was sunstroke. So you had to be upfront and personal with the young Marines to keep them moving, because I'll tell you, it was just difficult terrain and difficult environment to operate in.
Could you explain what elephant grass is, Duff?
I guess the way I would name it, if you've ever been to the seashore and see the grass they put on dunes to try and hold them, only these grew up to sometimes, well, over a man's height, particularly mine. I'm a short guy, so, I mean, you couldn't see. In other words, it was almost like walking in a tunnel, because the grass was higher than you were. So you couldn't see. If the enemy just lay, if he just set up a position in the elephant grass, you could walk right by him without never seeing him.
And then how would you talk to me about logistics for a second? How were you guys resupplied in terms of, did they resupply you by ground? Did they resupply you by air? And then what did you do for water when it was that hot? And there was no Camelback back then. All right, you had your how many canteens would you carry? Just the normal two?
You carry four or five canteens, and you had the magazines, of course. So you had the magazines, you had the four or five canteens. Most of the resupply, it depended on the duration of the operation. If you were just out for, let's say, 2 or 3 days, basically you ate what was on your back. You had the meal ready to eat. Basically, you filled your backpack with them and carried them with you. And then every third day, they would try to make a helo insert where they would drop off food and water, and we'd resupply there. Most of the water, there was enough streams around there, but you never knew what you were drinking, but there were enough streams around there that every time you crossed the water, you always made sure you filled up your canteens. And then you had to instill discipline with the young Marines, make sure that they conserve water, even though you told them to drink as much water so that they wouldn't be dehydrated. It sounds kind of counterintuitive, but you had to kind of do both, conserve while at the same time make sure you drink. But it was tough going. You could probably lose 4 or 5 pounds just in one day, just because of the heat.
And when you would take water out of the stream, did you guys have water purifiers, or did you just
we had halazone tablets.
Okay.
I'm not sure how good they were, but that's what we had. We didn't have purifiers with us. We just had these packets of pills that we would drop a couple into the thing, shake it up, and it supposedly it killed whatever was in there.
So now you personally, physically, you're a runner, and you subsequent to this, you run you'll run marathons. How did the environment affect you physically?
I guess I was motivated more just because, you know, you were an officer. Even though I was the FO, you were an officer in a leadership position. I think you just kind of, you know, you couldn't grumble and blame it on they and stuff like that. You just kind of had to push through, and because you were the, I don't think the term role model is apropos, but it's close to it, you know, that the troops look at you. And so, you know, if you're making it and you're usually 4 or 5 years older than they were, if you're doing it, then most of the troops do it. Your staff NCOs, some of them were not in good shape, and they got in shape. It was a challenge. The running aspect, it didn't apply, really. I guess you really had to just put one foot in front of the other. I think the biggest thing was trying to keep the attention span up, because it was easy to just put your head and kind of go into a elephant type, you know, just follow the guy in front of you. And because it was so hot, and because it was the elephant grass was so high, you really didn't get to see too much around you. So there was nothing much to keep your attention level going. And you were... If you're an introvert, it was probably a perfect environment.
My guest today on another edition of Battlefield Study is retired Marine Corps General Butch Neal, and we're talking about his time in Vietnam, 1966, 1967. Right now we're talking about his time with India Company, 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines. in during Operation Prairie 3. So talk to us about fire support. How your job as CFO, are you a first lieutenant at this time, or are you still a second lieutenant? And what about in terms of fire support, what's at your disposal?
Yeah, I was a second lieutenant. I had at my disposal the battery that I had was a composite battery. It had 6 105s and 2 155 howitzers. And then we had access in Julian and also in Camp Carroll. They had 175 shooters, and I think they had 8-inch as well.
Wow.
So as far as fire support, we had ample resources to tap into if in fact we got into a fight, or if we used it for H&I's harassing and interdicting fires at night. So from a artillery point of view, we were pretty well stocked as to the availability of resources when and if we needed them.
All right, talk to us about Operation Prairie 3. You guys are out. What's your mission? What are you supposed to be doing?
Well, it was really kind of a coordinate sweep. We were we kind of had a spot on a map where they wanted us to kind of end up for the night, and basically the orders were that we would set up three platoon-sized ambushes at different locations. The Captain Mike Getlin, we had seen indications as we were moving through the heavy and dense foliage. We had seen indications of recent enemy activity, footprints, discarded material, and I'm saying, you know, really new stuff, not old stuff. This was new indication that the enemy was in the area. You could actually smell the NVA. There was just a distinct odor that you could smell and pick up. I don't know if it was the food or what it was, but you kind of knew they were in the area. Captain Gatlin went back to the battalion and said, "Hey, you know, there's a lot of enemy out here. I suggest that we not break the company up into three platoons, but in fact we establish a couple close platoon/company defensive positions, ambush positions, and we wait until daylight and then we move out again and the continuation of the search and destroy." Now that was denied. He basically very forcefully argued against it, but was told to carry out his orders, which we did. Form up three platoon ambush sites that he pinpointed on the map. We suggested John Prickett, actually one of the platoon commanders, said, "Why don't we just sandbag it and not go to those positions?" And he said, "You know, I've been thinking about that." Gatlin did, but I don't like to disobey orders, one, and then number two, I don't like telling battalion you're one place when in fact you're not there. Should some fires go in there, we could get people hurt inadvertently through friendly fire. So we carried out the mission. He said because 1st Platoon was going to be the furthest one out, that was John Prickett's platoon, he decided to put me with him in case he figured if anyone got into trouble, it would be Prickett's platoon. So I was out with the 1st Platoon. The 2nd Platoon was split up. About half of it was to stay with the company headquarters, who was located on a small hill called 70, and then 3rd Platoon was to stay where they were, and they were going to put up their ambush site there. So that's kind of how it all shaped out. He broke up, he had weapons platoon assigned different weapon systems to John's platoon and to the other platoons, the reinforced platoons, and so we moved out to get into our ambush position before dusk. And that's when shit hit the fan.
So did you have assigned targets, fire support targets already worked up, or would it be simply you adjust and fire off contact that was made at any given point?
Yeah, I did some map spotting where the supposed ambush position was going to be. We never really got there. I didn't really worry too much about it. I I knew I could adjust fire from just about anywhere. That wouldn't be a problem. And I had pretty good map location as to where we were and where we were going. So I wasn't too concerned about that. I was a little concerned because of breaking up the company. And of course, there's only one FO. So, you know, if third platoon got in trouble, it could cause them some problems. But, fortunately that didn't come into play in what happened as we got there.
All right. What is the first indication of enemy contacts, or is it the mortars that they started dropping?
Yeah, because all of a sudden we were moving out, and we were probably 500 meters away from the headquarters company or from the company CP, and I heard mortars drop in. We stopped the platoon. John did stop the platoon, called back, and talked to Captain Gatlin and said, "Hey, Skipper, you want us to turn around and come back?" He says, "No, I think it's just a couple, harassing rounds." And then the next thing we heard was more mortars, and then we heard AK-47. So the next thing I heard was Gatlin was on the phone to me. He said, "Butch, give me all the fire support you can." He gave me the grids, and I remember saying, "That's your position." He says, "Yeah, they're in the position." So I called in the fire support, and then John and I, we turned the platoon around and went back, headed towards where the CP group was located. And we came around the corner, and the enemy had already gotten himself in between our route and CP, and so we ran into a real sandwich there, getting into heavy combat. John, the platoon commander, was a few steps ahead of me. He was hit seriously, and then I had to take over the platoon at that particular time. And once that machine gun I talked about, that 30 caliber on wheels, I could see it, and my first order was rocket team up. These two guys came scrambling, and two Marines came scrambling out of somewhere and hit a 3.5-inch rocket launcher. And I pointed to where they had to do one shot. The machine gun went up in the air, and from there we just went into a counterattack mode and wiped out the enemy there, and then fought our way towards the command group.
So talk about at what point does it dawn on you that you are now the platoon commander?
Well, initially, maybe I was in denial. I've got John laying in front of me. He's got a shot through the hip in serious pain. I'm yelling for a corpsman while I'm trying to get that rocket team going. The noise is unreal. And I finally get a corpsman up there. I'm trying to staunch the bleeding, and I kind of look up, and I see a lot of Marines looking at me. And I realized that my book title is "My What Now, Lieutenant" moment had arrived. You got the wand because John was seriously wounded, but that wasn't my job at the moment. So I took over the platoon, but I didn't take it over. I just basically started giving orders. The rocket team up was the first order, and then after that, John had trained his squad leaders really well and his fire team really well. So it was a matter of just pointing out where I wanted them to move and giving orders out, and guys responded as Marines always do, and overran the enemy quite quickly, and then we continued to move towards the command group where we were headed originally. And by the time we got there, Captain Gatlin had already been killed. Found him, and then John Bobo, you could tell where he was standing. He had been mortally wounded as well, but we drove the enemy off the hill, and then the FAC had been killed, so I became the forward air controller and started using the gunships to great effect against the retreating enemy. These guys were all NVA,
Right.
Fifth helmets, the whole shoot and match. These guys were good. And they actually had captured two of the radio operators from the FAC team, and fortunately we were able to, they dropped the guys they were taking as prisoners when we made a gun run on them. So the air really played a big portion of the fight.
And you were able to get them back were able to get them back. And so,
that's correct.
So at what point do you take over the company?
Now, you know, I don't know if I could ever really pinpoint it. The remnants of, I should say, the real fighting ability of the first platoon, the one that I had taken over from John, and then I realized that Captain Gatlin was killed, the first sergeant who usually doesn't go out with us. He was trying to run air, and he just, you know, I just said, hey, Top Rogers, I got it. So basically, I took over the FAC, and then I just realized that, you know, I was probably the senior guy there. At least I was the one in the fight, because the 3rd platoon really wasn't in it too bad, and the 2nd platoon, Dan Pulse, was brand new, so he was kind of following my lead. So I guess it was just a natural migration from Fort Observer to Corpsman to Rifleman to platoon commander to ultimately company commander and then FAC. So it kind of had 6 or 7 different hats on there at any one time.
You didn't
separate them out. They just kind of were all joined at the hip.
So are 3rd platoon and weapons back with you, or are they still separate from you at this time?
No, I had portions of weapons with me that were on the hill. Those guys that were on the hill at Hill 70, where the headquarters thing, that's the covering fire that Lieutenant Bobo provided for them so that they could move to a secondary position. And there was some 2nd platoon Marines that were with them as well. They were either wounded or they had moved back to the 2nd position while we were closing in on Hill 70 ourselves. And so there was a kind of a melding of the two company of two platoons of what was the remnants of 2nd platoon and of course my 1st platoon guys. And 3rd platoon was separated enough. I just told him to stay in place because I was afraid of friendly fire, and I didn't need him at that particular time because I had already cleared Hill 70 of the bad guys, and now it was more of a pursuit by fire using the artillery and the air while we're consolidating our position and then trying to find out our killed and our wounded.
Got it. The if you don't mind, I mean, we've all heard. I'd be curious to hear your version of Lieutenant Bobo's actions. I think most of us that will listen to this that are officers have stood outside of his chow hall. Some of us have worked with the MPF ship that bears his name. But I think that it's one of the humbling experiences in life when I can remember standing outside his chow hall reading what was on the plaque and thinking, holy shit, you know, that guy, you know, wasn't here that long ago. I went through OCS in 1983. He wasn't here that long ago, and look at that. Can you talk about what he did that day?
Yeah, John was a wonderful guy. Frickett and I were sort of hellraisers, and John was, I always said to him, I said, you should have been a priest. You know, he went to a Catholic, Niagara University, which is a Catholic school. Wonderful guy, just a great sense of humor, just kind of salt of the earth, someone that you could depend on. And of course, it came through in spades during this time. But essentially what happened, as they were overrunning the command group, the enemy soldiers, John's bottom portion of his leg was blown off just below the knee, and the corpsman put a tourniquet on it, and they were getting ready to medevac him back to alternate positions, and he said, no, I got to get the troops back there. I'll provide covering fire, and then we can move back. And basically, he took the stump of his leg and stuck it into the ground. That's how I found him. Stuck it in the ground to stop the bleeding, and then he provided covering fire for his weapons platoon guys and portions of the 2nd platoon to move back to alternate defensive positions. And in doing that, basically you know, exposed himself to enemy fire and held him off until he was overwhelmed. But there's not much you can say beyond that, except that he probably saved an awful lot of young Marines from certain death, because at that particular time they were in an extremist position as far as the enemy closing in on them. But his actions basically prevented that from occurring.
Your company commander's the recipient of the Navy Cross, as are three other Marines in that company. This is just me in my own cursory search. I don't know that I've ever heard of that. A Medal of Honor and is it three or four Navy Crosses are awarded in one
company? Yeah, we had the corpsman Doc Braun got it, but he didn't get it until 35 years later. I actually pinned it on him after I retired. We had to keep the ball rolling to get Headquarters Marine Corps to get that going. Mike Gatlin, the captain, got it. Basically, he carried a shotgun as a company commander, and it was through his actions as he told the command group to move to alternate positions. He basically stationed himself in a position where he provided covering fire for them to move to the rear until he was overcome by the enemy. Top Rogers, I mentioned him earlier, normally didn't go out with us. He stayed in the rear to take care of the troops that weren't on the operation, but he wanted to be out with us, so thankfully he was there. Basically, he took over some of the responsibilities around the command group until I told him I had it, and he basically fired up all the young Marines to fight to the rear and move to alternate positions. I talked about Top Braun. Basically, he was all over the field treating the wounded and firing his weapon system until he was shot three times, and basically he saved a number of lives. And then the last guy was Jack Laurinaitis, a Lance Corporal, kid out of Pennsylvania, unbelievable kid. He'd already won the Silver Star three or four months before, took over in Ontos and prevented the enemy taking over a position that it looked like they were overrun. For that, he got the Silver Star. And this time around, he moved to the 60 mortars, took command of the 60 mortar folks, and used them to hold back the enemy until they ran out of ammunition. Then he basically armed himself with a M14 and held off the enemy again until the mortar folks were able to get to a safer position before he was killed. So, yeah, there was four Navy Crosses and one Medal of Honor. It was touch and go for a while.
So the aftermath, I think until you're involved and you faced it as a second lieutenant, but the aftermath of all of this. So you beat back that attack, as you said, touch and go, and then what? You have, what is it, 15 killed, 47 wounded. I'm sure some of the wounded are their lives are hanging in the balance. So what time of day is it? What are you going to do with the wounded, and how do you navigate all that?
Yeah, that was some of the toughest time, because obviously the battle in a sense was over. The enemy was fleeing, and air was taking care of them. Now we had to try and figure out, get reorganized. And it was dark, obviously. This whole thing began just before dusk, and so it was dark. We sent out a couple teams to locate wounded and dead, and thank God we did. They came back with the wounded that probably would have died if they had stayed out in their position overnight. We got the wounded up there, and then we basically did a triage to figure out who were the most serious. Obviously, that was not within my purview. Had corpsmen doing that, and we singled out 15 that probably would not make it through the night if we didn't get them out. So I got we called it a medevac bird, and it was a H-34, I think, if I remember right, the number. And we guided him in, got him in, and I asked the pilot how many he could take, and he said, well, 9 or 10, I guess they don't have weapons or anything. I said, no, they're clean. And so we put all 15 on this one helicopter, and I held my collective breath as the guy churned it up, and he bounced a couple times, but he got up in the air, and postscript was that all 15 of them made it. So it was that was good. And then, as you said, we had 47 that were wounded and 15 that were KIA, and then the ones that we didn't medevac, those the ones remaining that we didn't medevac, basically were able to get out the next day. They weren't of such a nature that we were going to lose them if we didn't get them out.
Got it. So throughout the rest of the evening, any more contact?
That night, no. I had Dan Pulse was the other platoon commander that was with me. I had him get a hold of the surviving leadership and bring him. We got into a, you know, into a foxhole type configuration, and you know, I just kind of had to keep an eye on them. You know, they were all, as you can well imagine, everyone had lost friends, and
is this their first real punch in the face in terms of the first time that on this scale that, I mean, obviously, you know, given the awards for valor that were given out and the number of KIA, had they been in anything, in a fight like anything close to this before this?
No, not of that scale and intensity. This was probably the first for all of us. I mean, I'd been in firefights, but most of us, when we came up, as I told you previously, NVA was kind of hit and run type things. Not NVA, but Viet Cong, and was kind of hit and run. You know, snipers. It was frustrating, but it wasn't in your face type fight. This is the first time we had really got into face to face with a professional war fighting warrior, if you want the word. So there was some shook up troops, there was some shook up leadership, and so I got all the leadership that was remaining, or those that I had now starting to designate as leaders, and it's a term I've used ever since, is eyeball level leadership, is looking them in the eye and say, okay guys, you gotta get back to your men, and you gotta do it in such a means that they understand that you're real satisfied with their performance, but they also are Marines, they gotta start take an inventory, they got to clean their weapons, and they got to be ready in case there's a re-attack or a counter-attack. And so, you know, yeah, it was that kind of got them all fired up again, and basically the night was quiet. Next morning we collected intel on enemy dead and wounded and equipment, and we were motored out of there probably about 3 or 4 hours later.
So when you walking around and I mean, if people, I think it's hard for people to imagine, but you still have the dead Marines with you, right? Correct?
That's correct.
You still have your dead friends are inside body bags, if you're lucky, ponchos most likely. You're going around and you're gathering, your weapons and gear, and then the enemy's weapons and gear. When you're looking at their weapons and gear, sir, what did you conclude about them?
I guess the thing I concluded, but I kind of knew it from, you know, being in the fight, so to speak, you know, and they being in uniform. We really hadn't run into guys in uniforms before. You know, I mean, they might have black trousers and stuff, but these guys were, you know, they had helmets, they had, you know, they had good uniforms, they had good weapon systems, they had supporting arms, albeit mortars and machine guns, but this was a professional outfit. Mm-hmm. And so when I looked around, you know, you look at we were trying to do site exploitation, you know, to get as much intel as we could to share with the intel guys when we get back to the rear. But yeah, I mean, this was the first time that we had as a company I can't speak for the battalion. You know, I was only a lowly lieutenant, but as a company, it was the first time we had really run into a sophisticated, well-trained enemy.
Well, talk to us about the... So the rest of the day, you police everything up. I want to ask you one more question about the eyeball-to-eyeball leadership, because I have a son who's one's teaching at the basic school right now, and the another one's the XO of Kilo Company 3-5. And he and I were talking about this. I brought this term up to him last night, eyeball-to-eyeball leadership. When you talk to leaders about what that is and what that means, what do you try to convey to them in terms of what eyeball leadership is?
To me, it's a visible presence. It's you know, they watch you all the time, the young junior Marines. You know, an officer, you know, you're under a microscope whether you know it or not. And they know if you're competent. They know if you're concerned about them. They know if you're a professional. And so eyeball level leadership means, you know, you're an engaged leader. You make yourself a visible presence, whether it's in the barracks, whether it's out in the field, whether it's in the motor pool, whether it's in the armory. It doesn't matter. Because you're the role model. You're the guy or gal that sets the standard and represents the standard, I guess. You're also their educator and you're also their mentor. So, you know, it's very easy nowadays, given technology being what it is, to get yourself computer focused and staying in your office and thinking that you're a good commander because you know all the data associated with your particular outfit. But the real leader is the guy that gets out from behind that desk, gets out from behind that computer, and gets down in those different workspaces on a routine basis, whether it's the mess hall at 0500 or 1700 when they're eating, or at the end of a field exercise, you form a school circle, and you commend them and you critique them, and you make them feel good about that you're interested in their learning experience. And then the other thing I always see as an eyeball level leadership is you should know every weapon system you have in that platoon or that company or even that battalion, because you don't know. You might be an FO today, but you might well be a platoon commander tomorrow, or you may well be a corpsman the next day, or you may well be just a rifleman, which we all are. So there's no such thing as, oh, that's not my job, or I don't do windows. That doesn't work anymore. It shouldn't have worked in 1966, 67. But, you know, we've learned from that. But sometimes lessons learned are soon forgotten.
The next step is going back and obviously and boxing up people's personal effects. And as your company does that, you're summoned to Dong Ha, where the 3rd Marine Division Forward CP is, yes?
Yeah, I think that's where it was. As a lieutenant, I honestly don't know where I went, but they flew me there. So it wasn't Camp Carroll, that's for sure.
All right. And what was the purpose of that? Obviously, this was, again, they had been fighting these larger battles for a while, for the past, what, 60 the past 60 days, and now you guys are part of it. What were they interested in flying you back, sir?
I think they really wanted to talk to someone that had eyes on the battle that was there, and obviously it was pretty significant battle when you lost a company commander, when you lost the forward air controller, when you lost a couple platoon commanders to wounds. You know, It was significant enough with a 15 KIA and 47 WIA that they wanted to kind of, what can we learn from this? I think there was a lot of, you know, I was only a lieutenant, so, you know, a lot of this is speculation on my part. I'm sure there was a lot of, was there malfeasance or poor leadership that might have led to this? Well, initially when I talked to the staff and the CG, I think he was a 2-star at that time, whoever he was, I can't remember. You know, there was sort of, they were looking at Ketlin might not have done what he should have done as a company commander, and I quickly divested them of that. And I told them about his arguments with battalion headquarters and the staff about the concept of operations that they had developed and his his hesitancy to execute that because of his personal experience of seeing enemy activity in the area. And so, you know, I don't think I don't think that's what they wanted to hear, but they also knew that I was the guy that was there, had seen it, and that was it. I mean, the next day they had a formation and they gave me a silver star in the Marine Corps. That doesn't happen.
Yeah, I wanted to ask that. Like, that's pretty quick. How did that happen?
I never got a certificate. They showed me a message from PAC, signed by General Kulak's dad. Basically, you know, with a write up that, you know, I don't know where they got all the information from, but they basically, and the next day I'm out there in formation, getting the Silver Star. You know, surprised. I mean, I was surprised probably more than they were. But I don't even think it was ginned up. I know it wasn't ginned up by the battalion. And it probably wasn't even ginned up by division, although I can't be sure on that.
Right. The other interesting part about that visit is you cross paths with a major on the division staff by the name of Gray. Talk to us about that, because in your book you write about that you were underwhelmed by what you had just participated in terms of trying to maybe assign blame to Captain Getlin and somebody who you looked up to tremendously. And but beyond once you had dissuaded them of that, there wasn't really a whole lot of interest in keeping you around and discussing what had happened. And then you bump into Major Gray. Relate that story to everybody.
Yeah, it was kind of funny. As you mentioned, I wasn't really happy, convinced that the interest level at the division level was really to figure out what lessons learned could be gleaned from what occurred or didn't occur during that night engagement, and what we could do better or correct to make sure it doesn't happen again. But I bumped into this major who I think was looking for me, Al Gray, Major Gray, who would, as those in the Marine Corps know, ultimately would be our commandant of the Marine Corps. But he was really interested, and he wanted to find out from A to Z what had occurred. And he picked my brain and asked the right questions and made the right statements that made me remember other things that went on in the battle. And so it was very interesting because, as you know, when he became commandant, one of his greatest achievements as commandant was introducing professional military education into the officer corps and to the Marine Corps writ large. And he was a serious student of history and wanted to make sure that when men and women raised their right hand and took the oath of office either as an officer or an enlisted, that in fact they had the opportunity to have the best leaders available to them. And he basically made us become more professional and understand that we were joining a profession, not just joining an outfit that was a Marine Corps or an Army or whatever. So he followed that up throughout his career, and we're better for it.
You know, interestingly enough, I first heard about General Gray as this guy. Yeah, he either promotes you or he'll give you an award, and then he'll haul off and he'll smoke you right in the chest. And he had this, you know, he had this bulldog look and kind of mentality and this fiery personality, but then he also has this other side, this incredibly intellectual side, and also, you know, he's really, I mean, the guy who pushed maneuver warfare into the Marine Corps, and that whole thought that I think maybe, I'd be curious about your thoughts, that whole renaissance of thought of this, of our craft, of the way we go about it, the systems that we use, He's this dichotomy of people, this gruff, hard-nosed puncher. And he would. I saw him do it. I was like, holy shit, man, he smoked that guy. And but it was this great, I don't know how to call it, this great welcoming ceremony, this celebration of a tough core. And he let you know about it, and his fire, but also this incredibly, like, the tale of two cities. He has this other personality that's incredibly intellectual and really changes the Marine Corps. Your thoughts on General Gray and his gift to the Marine Corps?
Oh, for sure. I mean, he brought warrior back into warfighting. And as you pointed out, he basically gave birth and impetus to maneuver warfare. Basically, he had read Bill Lind's writing, he had read John Boyd's writing, he made sure that the schools were teaching maneuver warfare and embracing it, and he did it by action indeed. And he made me the director of the amphibious warfare school, now the expeditionary warfare school. And he made Paul Van Riper the commanding officer of Command and Staff College. And he basically, in no uncertain terms, made sure that we understood that our curriculums were dedicated to everything maneuver and maneuver warfare. And then he published a series of pamphlets, the FMFM series of pamphlets on warfighting. And it was just this whole aura of the warrior and warfighting and what this profession was all about that he basically brought to the table and infused in the Marine Corps. He basically rejuvenated the idea of the legacies laid out by the Belleau Woods experience in World War One. That's where, that's where the Marine Corps really established a legacy of warfighting excellence and tenacious ability to close with and defeat the enemy. And he basically brought that to the fore.
In fact, that thing's still echoing through American history as French President Macron brought a sapling from Belleau Woods. I mean, of all the different places that he could pull saplings out of, the Marine Corps, that the power of our own.
Yeah, well, it's the 100th anniversary here in June.
Our own
from June 1st to June 26th, the fighting around in Belleau Woods and around there, where the Marines made a name and basically saved the French and the British, because through our actions in Belleau Woods, that's the first defeat the Germans really suffered. At that particular time, it was the AEF, the American Expeditionary Force, under Pershing. And Pershing was reluctant to turn the American forces over to the French because of trench warfare, and he just felt the leadership just wasn't what he wanted to do. But when the Eastern Front folded and the Germans were able, and the Russians had surrendered, and the Germans were turning 50 divisions, looking at France and Paris in particular, Pershing changed his mind. Of course, that's when guys like, Dan Daly, a two-time Medal of Honor winner, said, come on, you sons of bitches. You want to live forever. Six bayonets, we're going for it. And that's where the legacy of warfighting excellence really took birth.
Kind of switch gears and talk about lessons learned. I think it's appropriate, talking about General Gray. We now have a command and control system that talks about commander's intent and understanding what he's trying to achieve. And if you're a company commander, making sure that what you're doing is lining up with them. I've had Jarvis Lynch on. I've had a first lieutenant from Way City who by the name of Nick War, who was in Charlie 1-5 and lost 30 of 50 guys in three frontal attacks inside the old city. On when 1-5 went in there. And I think I've read the same, I don't know if hand-wringing, but the same frustration that somebody on a radio is telling me to do something that they don't really know what's going on here. You know, General Lynch got told as an officer, get your battalion back into an LZ because an arc light's going in. The arc light went in nowhere near their position, and they medevaced 150. You know, Captain Gettling, he pushes back, and at the end of the day, he's being a good Marine. He's doing what he's supposed to do. But the guy, the ops on the other end of that radio, he doesn't have the same sense that you have. I'm curious, you've had 51 years to reflect on this. Your thoughts on commander's intent now and a commander's responsibility and maybe a leeway now in our command and control system that a commander has that really wasn't, you know, probably part of what the Marine Corps did in 1967.
Yeah, I think maneuver warfare basically is successful only if there's a spirit of trust between the command and the commanded. And I think that trust is born from competence and professionalism. And I think that's what we're trying to convey to down to the lowest level. But it's a balancing game because you know damn well that the commander thinks that he's right, even though he doesn't have eyes on the ground, and the ability to command and control has been simplified, you know, with the advent of different technologies. But I just got to hope that, you know, the Haitian Armada Basic School, I'm sure your son can attest to it, they're still talking about commander's intent and the spirit of trust and trust tactics. And the ability to be agile and at the same time, you know, be able to make decisions. You know, I always talk about the four things that I think are critical to leadership in the Marine Corps. And I talk about, you know, dedication. I talk about integrity. I talk about judgment. And I talk about, I lost my train of thought because I almost tripped here. But courage, you know, and courage is kind of the interesting one because I'm not so much talking about physical courage. I'm talking about moral courage and the ability to step back when someone's giving an order that you know is foolish enough and you tincture your response with common sense and say, you know, tell him it's wrong. Tell him he's got the wrong sight picture and that in fact, you're gonna execute the mission as articulated by the commander's intent that I understand what at the end of the day you want me to do. And you have to have the moral courage to accept the consequences, which may be, you know, ultimately you may get relieved or you may, in fact, that was sort of one of the stipulations that Mike Gettling faced. Well, if you want to do it, I'll find someone who will. Well, you know, I think that's when you lose calm.
You know what? Those are hard, you know, because you don't want to be. You've always been like, I think a lot of Marine officers. You're no exception. I think we grew up in a similar way. I mean, you grew up playing team sports. You're on the team. I'm not going to shirk my. You know, what am I going to do? Shirk my duty? No, I'm going to do it in, probably in a way that makes more sense to me. And your story is so similar to General Lynch's in terms of, you know, smart guys pushing back, and then somebody on the other end of the phone, and I'm not sure positive in your case, but you know that will be relieved after this happens doesn't have the common sense to turn back and say, hey, if that's what you think is best, you know. Hey, hey, Mike, if that's what you think is best, do what you see best. If they don't have that trust the other way, because that's exactly what should happen, you know, what do you and the rest of your op staff know about what's going on this piece of ground right now? What the deuce told you? Well, hell, I'm out here. I can tell the deuce what's going on, and he can learn from me. And so, you know, it's just, you know, reading that is you know, hearing about that is certainly frustrating.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, sir. Any other – this is the general question before I let you go. Are there any other things about, you know, about this fight on the 30th and the 31st that is referred to? You refer to it as Gettling's Corner, yes?
Yeah, the they did an article on it in Leatherneck, and it was and when it was written from the perspective of a couple Marines that were in the command group, and so there was actually two battles as far as I could see. It was the battle of the command group trying to survive, and the battle of First Platoon turning around and trying to help get to the command group to relieve them. And so you had two battles seen through two sets of eyes, or, you know, different sets of eyes.
Right.
And that happens all the time. And thank God we had some great Marines on that hill, or whatever, Hill 70 is really just something on the map. But thank God we had some great Marines there, and then we had some great Marines who was the platoon, John Prickett's platoon, that I ultimately took command of, that closed with the enemy, you know, fearlessly. And it was inspiring to kind of watch them and have the opportunity to lead them in action, and they responded to commands quickly. And I think that just, you know, they epitomized the, I'll say, the Belleau Wood spirit. You know, they were ready to fix bayonets if we had to.
My guest for probably too long has been General Butch Neal, United States Marine Corps retired, an artilleryman by trade. We're talking about action on the 30th and the 31st of March in 1967 in the vicinity of Compiègne and the Camloe combat bases north of Camp Carroll. Sir, first of all, there's no way I could say thank you enough for giving me the couple hours today. But thank you very much. I can tell you that thousands of people will listen to this. And my hope is, by getting the chance to hear you talk in detail about these kind of events, that the things that you talk about, the things that you put emphasis on, go into their brains. And if they're ever crossed with similar situations, that they take heed of your lessons and are wiser and better leaders than their age would indicate because of these kind of things. So thank you very much.
Okay, Mac. We'll look forward to talking to you again.
That is General Butch Neal, United States Marine Corps retired. He's an artilleryman by trade. He's a veteran of the Vietnam War. If you paid attention during Desert Storm, you saw he was the spokesperson for General Schwarzkopf and Central Command. So my thanks to him for coming on and doing that. You'll hear him again in probably about a week when he comes back to talk about his book, What Now, Lieutenant? Don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.